Hello and welcome to the Permaculture Podcast with Scott Mann, a listener-supported program. My guest for this episode is David Holmgren, one of the co-originators of permaculture and author of some of the fundamental books on this subject, including Permaculture 1 and Permaculture: Principles and Pathways Beyond Sustainability. I wanted to talk to David largely because of my curiosity. His contributions to this field are many, but what I knew of him and his work were, as you'll hear, a bit of a mystery. So rather than continue on with conjecture and bits and pieces from different sources, why not take the opportunity to talk with him, to learn about the history of permaculture, those first days, his work in the decades since, and where we can take permaculture in the future. I knew from conversations with other practitioners and some of the listeners to the show that there was a desire to know more about Mr. Holmgren, to hear his own words in his own voice. Our conversation today covers, as I say, a broad range of his work in the history of permaculture, including developing these ideas with Bill Mollison, and then how permaculture has progressed through three waves of environmentalism that he identifies: a limit of resources in the 1970s, a limit of what we can put into the environment during the late 1980s and 1990s, and the convergence of these ideas together into a third wave over the last decade or so. We wrap up the interview by talking about how to continue to grow permaculture. And that conversation took a direction that initially surprised me, but in reflection makes plenty of sense. If you like this interview, consider supporting the show. Go to thepermaculturepodcast.com/support. There you can make a one-time or recurring monthly donation that goes a long way to helping me continue to produce this podcast. You'll also find out how to follow the show on Facebook or Twitter. Now then, on to David Holmgren. I'll join you with some updates after the interview. Mr. Holmgren, if you are ready, could you give us a little bit about your background and biography and the first early days of permaculture?
Yeah, well, I suppose it's a long story for me because it started when I was a student in environmental design in Tasmania in the early 1970s. And I was very interested in the overlap between landscape architecture as a profession, agriculture as a subject area, and using ecological thinking in that fusion. And I really couldn't find anything that really dealt with that overlap. You could find the overlap between two of those, but not between all three. And it was at that time that I met Bill Mollison by chance, and he was actually lecturing in another institution for me and not in any of those subjects. He was a senior tutor, actually, in the psychology faculty of the Tasmanian University. And I was a student in environmental design, which probably in retrospect, I would say, was probably the most radical experiment in tertiary education in Australia's history, in that there was no fixed curriculum, there was no fixed timetable. A third of the staff budget was for visiting lecturers and outside professionals. There was self-assessment up to submission of a thesis, and undergraduate and postgraduate students worked collaboratively on interdisciplinary projects, and the department functioned as a consultancy service to in the public domain. So that's the context in which I met Bill Mollison and developed, I suppose, a student-mentor relationship, even though he was never formally, we never had any sort of formal relationship in that. And it was in those years, 1974-75, when I was sharing house with him and we were developing an extensive garden and constantly articulating these ideas, and I was working basically full-time in my course purely on the manuscript that became Permaculture One. So for me, that initial starting point was a full-time focus. I suppose in those early years, I was also very passionate about the practical side of things more than the academic side of things. And at the completion of my thesis, instead of going on to do postgraduate work, I just launched myself into all of the practical aspects of permaculture at the same time that Bill Mollison was tiring of his position as a senior tutor within the confines of a psychology faculty. And he launched himself into really the public domain in promoting Permaculture One, which was published in 1978. And there was a huge amount of interest at that time. And some of that, of course, is attributable to Bill Mollison's charismatic nature, but most of it really needs to be attributed to the times. That 1978 was one of those, in that pivotal, what I call the first wave of modern environmental thinking, between the two oil crises of 1973 and 79. There was this huge interest in what today we would call sustainability. And that interest was right from the counterculture sort of fringe, if you like, right through to mainstream public policy issues. And that led to this enormous interest in permaculture, both in Australia and then very quickly overseas as well. And for someone who was, well, in 1978, when that book was published, I was 23 years old. That was, I suppose, a bit of a shock in a way, and I didn't know quite how to deal with that. Whereas Bill Mollison was, as I said, middle-aged, looking for a larger stage, a broader audience, and a platform on which to engage with the wider world about the environmental crisis and the solutions to it.
As someone who came to permaculture, if you will, rather later in the game, first becoming aware of it in the late 90s as we were facing the issues of Y2K and the concerns of that becoming a crisis, and then moving out of those boom years of the 90s, we move into this period of uncertainty and this next wave where sustainability and with it permaculture are becoming a bigger part of the dialogue and conversation. And it's, for me, as after Permaculture One was published and the Designer's Manual, it seemed that Bill was really the one who was at the forefront. And then it wasn't until, at least in the international community, that your publication of Permaculture Principles and Pathways brought you back to the international stage, at least from the audience that I'm aware of and the folks who I know in the United States. I don't say that to seem unfair to the work that you've been doing, but just of one is perception. Where has your work gone through those years as Bill stepped out and you were doing the work in Australia and developing many of your books and writings and the teaching that you've been doing and your method of handling this material?
Well, I suppose just to provide more context rather than just the personal story, between those early years and your identification of that sort of wave of interest in permaculture in the late 90s and since, I would see a second great wave of both interest in permaculture and around environmentalism generally. And that was in the late 80s, which I call the second wave. And of course, that coincided with the publication of Bill Mollison's Designer's Manual, which is really an encyclopedia of permaculture design. And I see that wave in the broader sense of not just permaculture, but in the wider environmental sense, was driven by the awareness about the limits of the environment via climate change, whereas the first wave was driven by the idea of the limits of resources, and the thinking behind that came out of the limits to growth report of the Club of Rome of 1972, and then the oil crises sort of illustrating that issue. So limits of resources coming into society, and then the second wave, limits of what we can put into the environment, i.e. climate change. And then the third wave that you were talking about was really those two crises starting to come together in the form of peak oil and climate change. So I think those larger psychosocial and geopolitical contexts to an amazing degree shape what happens in people's personal lives. And for me, the 80s was a sort of going sort of away from mainstream society, recognizing that mainstream society was going off in all the wrong directions. And a lot of permaculture activism was definitely strongly in the counterculture. And for me, it was around just practically implementing and developing working examples of permaculture, first on my mother's property in southern New South Wales in the late 70s, early 80s, which was documented in a small publication called Permaculture in the Bush. And then in the mid 80s with the development of this property, Meliodora, which was documented in the mid 90s in a quite extensive book, and then more recently ebook about our property. So I was emphasizing to permaculture activists that the important thing was to have good working demonstration sites of permaculture, rather than just talking loudly to people about urgent problems, or alternatively saying how fantastic this permaculture concept is. Because the interest in permaculture was there, and it was easy to, sort of surprisingly easy when the social conditions are right, for that to grow. But unless there was the solid backup of working examples and then people with skills to enable and help people to go further with it, then a lot of that interest would just die when it sort of went out to try and do something. And I think at least within the permaculture movement in Australia, and to an extent for those who were interested, that emphasis I gave to the, we need to have the practical examples, both from a sort of activist effectiveness point of view, but also from a moral point of view, that you need to practice what you preach. You need to experiment on yourself before you tell other people to experiment, did have an effect in reinforcing other people's thoughts along the same lines. So I sort of, in a way, became known as, you know, the quiet practitioner who was sort of implementing things in a modest way. But it's interesting that in the late 80s, when there became again a greater opening and interest in these ideas, I ended up doing work that was also a bit more in the mainstream, a little bit more in the public domain. But it was around the land care movement in Australia, working with farmers on farm revegetation systems, but taking a permaculture approach to what was a larger, broader environmental movement that was supported by government and supported in rural communities in Australia. So a lot of that work didn't actually have a permaculture label on it initially. And the most notable of that is a design manual I did in the late 80s called Trees on the Treeless Plains, which is available as a downloadable file still. And it was really focusing on applying permaculture principles to revegetation on farm landscapes in the region where I lived. So it was very specific, though a lot of people have taken that and used the design principles in it to working with other landscapes. In the 1990s, really my work was also very much focused in this region, but it was on two major directions. The first was around the management of the public land on the fringes of the small village, Hepburn Springs, where I live, along Spring Creek, in an area we call the Spring Creek Community Forest. And this was really building on work I'd done in the 80s in New Zealand with a permaculture colleague, Hakai Tane, looking at what we called the process of ecosynthesis, of where nature was actually creating new ecosystems on damaged land out of a sort of hybrid of indigenous species and introduced species that had become naturalized. And so, and this has an older lineage going back in my work and also right through the origins of permaculture and back into the origins of organic agriculture in a positive view of weeds and what they tell us and what they're doing in the environment. So this theme about weeds or wild nature became quite controversial, both within the permaculture movement, but also it became one of the notorious aspects of permaculture in the wider environmental movement. I suppose my work in that did actually lead to permaculture being identified by some environmentalists as an environmentally damaging activity around the spreading of plants which were naturalizing. So, yeah, that was a major aspect.
Your comment about weeds and using plants that have already naturalized to an area, when I've given public presentations on permaculture and discussed natives versus non-natives and what we choose to plant and what we don't, initially there was a lot of conversation with people about, well, how can you take that kind of a viewpoint because of the destruction that it causes, because of the problems that arise from it? And I think that part of that was my own personal emerging view of native versus non-native species, as opposed to trying to have an invasive versus non-invasive conversation, because we could just as easily have something that would be native to the area considered invasive, depending on who's talking about it, but about how we use these different things in the environment, and that there's a difference between then within the zones of permaculture of where you might want to expand on those naturalized plants versus those places where you might not want to in order to preserve the biodiversity in an area. And having those conversations with people to try to kind of even out the understanding.
Yes, so this issue of weeds or wild nature, as I call it more, rather than natives versus exotics, because there's two related issues. There's the one of what one should be planting, but the other issue is how one should manage the wild. And I've been known for taking, I suppose, what was seen by a lot of people as a more extremist position, in that I was saying that the landscape, the outer zones of our managed landscape, zone four, the managed wild, is in reality a mixture of species from all different heritages almost everywhere. And this is now being confirmed by a whole field of research that since 2000 has taken off, and the terminology for it is novel ecosystems. And there's estimates that, you know, 30% of the planet is actually covered with novel ecosystems, 30% of the land area, which are effectively not intensively managed, you know, farm or other landscapes. They are actually wild places, but they are places where you couldn't really identify them as indigenous ecosystems with a few exotic species naturalized. They are actually new ecosystems evolving from new combinations of species that include, you know, some indigenous species and many other species from many, many different places. So what's happened since 2000 is gradually the scientific investigation of this issue has started to catch up finally with permaculture thinking and permaculture activism around these issues. And during the 80s and 90s, the 90s especially, I certainly felt that the whole thing of being a voice in the wilderness, so to speak, and even within permaculture, people found it necessary to moderate their views around this increasingly well-established orthodoxy about biodiversity. Now, I never accepted that orthodoxy as having a scientific foundation. And the criticism of permaculture along these lines was actually there at the beginning. In 1978, there was a couple of young environmentalists of about my age who were on public radio in Melbourne, community radio, who were talking about permaculture as the greatest threat to the environment. And it was interesting because it seemed to me a little bit hilarious in a way, a bit like Trotskyites and Maoists and Stalinists in the socialist left in the 1930s all fighting each other. But it did indicate this quite substantial difference in environmental thinking. And back then, in the late 70s, you could say permaculture and these ideas of indigenous revegetation around where we should only use indigenous species in all revegetation and landscaping were both very small fringe ideas. And what's interesting is that although permaculture actually has grown enormously in its influence, in many primarily English-speaking countries, indigenous revegetation has become almost an orthodoxy. Here in Australia, you know, the government programs and of land management are fully focused around these ideas. Of course, this is still very superficial because, on the other hand, our agriculture and our forestry are all based on, of course, exotic species. So there's a sort of almost a sort of schizoid sort of existence in the policy world. But that led in the 90s to quite a lot of focus for me on that subject. And that was very much grounded in our work in this area of public land where we were working along permaculture principles on a larger area of public land without public funding, without permission, and contrary to the current environmental orthodoxy. That work has continued to the present. The other thing that, going back to that story of what was I doing in the, prior to principles and pathways, was the development of the Friars Forest eco-village in central Victoria, not that far from here in Meliodora, 35 kilometres to the north. And for me, that was really about bringing together my passions for sustainable forestry, which was another area of intense interest, and the whole community ownership and organisation of land. Because, of course, permaculture from the beginning was quite closely associated with the whole idea and practice of creating intentional communities. So I suppose when Principles and Pathways was published in 2002, I did get the reaction that a lot of people were a bit surprised because they thought of me as a quiet practitioner, and then Principles and Pathways appeared then a very big picture and even abstract theoretical framework for permaculture through design principles. And I suppose my answer to that is, in a way, I've always been a big picture abstract thinker, but what I've done is use the practical day-to-day aspects of garden and land management and dealing with the nitty-gritty of practical local social interaction and all the issues that are involved in just being a part of a community that are sort of very down to earth, very, if you like, ordinary, as a grounding force for my big picture thinking. That stuff that, you know, brings you back down to earth and stops your head drifting away into the clouds. But yeah, I've always been that big picture sort of person.
Mentioning the big picture, I just have a personal question about this since I have you here, but this will go out to all the listeners, of course, too. My understanding is that the work of Howard T. Odom was one of the influences on you and permaculture. Is that correct?
Yes. Permaculture 1, the first reference in that book was Howard Odom's 1971 book, Power, Environment and Society. And I read that book in 1973, and for me it was extremely influential at that time that I was working with Bill Mollison in developing the permaculture concept. And then when I went to New Zealand in 1979 and first worked with Hakai Tane, that was a trigger for, again, a renewed interest in Howard Odom's work, and a book that was published around that time called Energy Basis for Man and Nature sort of renewed my interest and focus. And when I started teaching on permaculture design courses in the early 90s, I found the need to introduce some of the thinking behind Odom's work, especially around the idea of that there's no free lunch in ecological and energetic systems. Something's got to come from somewhere, because I found that a lot of the emphasis in permaculture teaching was a little bit too strongly on the human creativity and brilliance side of the equation, you know, that by thinking differently, we can sort of make every problem into a solution, which Mollison had tended to emphasize that side. And I think it is very, very important aspect of permaculture that it focuses on this human potential, creativity, you know, that imagination is the only limitation to the system sort of thinking. But given our past culture of really coming from the Enlightenment and supercharged by fossil fuels, we have a long history of this thinking humans are brilliant and that we can do anything type of approach. And when that combines with ignorance about energy and how energy underpins all natural systems, then it can be very limiting for a designer, if not dangerous, in leading to all sorts of hubris about impossible solutions to environmental dilemmas. So I suppose I also saw Odom's work as providing a scientific basis in systems ecology for permaculture. And of course, that's very ironic, because although Odom was clearly an enormously well-credentialed ecologist, that he and his brother Eugene Odom, you know, two of the great pillars holding up the American lineage of ecological science, Odom himself was really increasingly in the 70s and 80s and 90s marginalized as sort of fringe to a lot of the directions that ecological science had gone. And in a lot of ways, that I believe was a story about reductionist thinking, recapturing the science of ecology and limiting its potency. And of course, a lot of scientists would explain that saying, oh, well, those systems ecology ideas, you know, proved to be wrong. And that's just the way science goes. And, you know, they were fashionable and in favor at one stage, but the evidence didn't really support them. Whereas I don't really see it like that. I see that the powerful thinking that is in systems ecology had enormous implications for reshaping society and does give us a very insightful picture of the way nature works. That was certainly against the interests of a lot of establishment thinking. Now, I don't see this in some sort of conspiratorial terms, but I think a lot of scientists embedded in reductionist thinking took over ecology. And it's a little bit like how in local government always used to employ engineers, but they never had the money to employ planners. And when the planning profession became more fashionable and local government needed planners, there weren't many planners around, and engineers retrained themselves as planners, but they were still really engineers. Well, when ecology became very fashionable academically to study, there weren't many ecologists around, and a whole lot of botanists and zoologists who are essentially bit people, you know, passionate about the bits of nature, retrained themselves as ecologists and taught ecology. So they brought that reductionist thinking back into ecological teaching. And I see that that's actually what happened in academia. Permaculture was one of the ideas that was, yes, very powerfully influenced by the holistic thinking of systems ecology. And that's why my book, Principles and Pathways, is actually dedicated to Odum's memory.
I started with that question because when I came to permaculture, I was sitting with a copy of the designer's manual, Odum's Environment, Power, and Society, and Fukuoka's One Straw Revolution. Of those three, the only one that gave me a feeling that I had the intellectual capital to engage in permaculture was Fukuoka's, because it was this, okay, I can sit down and read this, and it's as much a life story as a philosophy. I had to read Odum's work, I think, 6 or 7 times before it finally clicked what he was trying to say, and I still only read the designer's manual in pieces. I've read the whole thing, but I've never read it in one go or decided to devote myself to it because there's just too much there, and I don't know that I have the brain power to do it.
Well, that's what I call the designer's manual an encyclopedia of permaculture design. I remember someone saying, just open it at any page and read that page and there'll be something in there for you. and maybe go away and think about it. But yeah, it's not necessarily a book that you would sit and read from cover to cover. Odum's first book was, yeah, extremely difficult. I mean, a much more accessible book, which was co-written with his wife, Elizabeth Odum, who was actually a high school teacher, and the book was written as a text for high schools and undergraduate university courses, Energy Basis for Man and Nature, 1979, I think that was published. That was a much more accessible book. And his last book, which was also co-authored with Elizabeth, The Prosperous Way Down, or A Prosperous Way Down, published just before his death in 2001, is really, again, that sort of more publicly accessible work. But I made efforts in the 90s to actually introduce Odum's sort of energy circuit language into permaculture course teaching, you know, with some degree of success, but it's certainly difficult concepts. for most people to digest in some ways.
Thinking about what you said about reductionist thinking within the sciences in these bits and pieces, I'm studying environmental education at the graduate level here in the United States, and much of the conversation that we have is about holistic thinking, and with that, the systems thinking that that's involved with that, to look at the big picture, to understand how these different pieces are related. And I come from a background in computer science, so I'm very familiar with the work of people such as the late Donella Meadows and systems thinking. But when I engage folks who don't come from that background, these kinds of ideas are really hard after generations of, well, we're going to break it down into a smaller piece and a smaller piece and a smaller piece. We're now at that ground view that to pull it back up to 30,000 feet, when I'm talking with some folks, that seems almost completely foreign to think, to begin to want to think about the world in that way, with how easy these little pieces are to pull.
Yes, well, that's, I've found over the years that talking to people from a background in computer science, cybernetics, organizational theory, and a whole lot of other areas that have been strongly influenced by systems thinking, and where, you know, the sort of holistic approaches in some form are taken as necessary, that to explain people who are using biological metaphors all the time in their work, because nature provides us with the greatest repertoire of intuitively accessible whole systems that we can imagine, because it's at our scale, it's not at the subatomic and it's not at the stellar, and that it's so diverse, nature's so diverse in the repertoire of systems, that these people are shocked to realize that the mainstream in biological science doesn't accept self-organization above the organism and the gene level. That concepts like the Gaia hypothesis, that, you know, the Earth functions as a living organism, are just seen as fairy tales. And this is starting to turn back towards the holistic a little bit now, but still the mainstream within the biological sciences doesn't use any or recognize any of these larger holistic approaches, because a lot of those lineages of in the biological sciences, it seems, have been cut out and replaced by the gene, and the molecular end of things was going to give us all the answers. And of course, you know, we've seen what's happened with genetic engineering, that they've essentially come up with nothing of substance so far. And yet the hubris 20 and 30 years ago was, you know, by now we were going to have nitrogen fixing wheat and, you know, a whole suite of other things that would have doubled and tripled, you know, agricultural productivity. So the failure of reductionist science in biology is really breathtaking. And the virtual absence of research on the, you know, more holistic approaches, like I was saying about the study of novel ecosystems, which is by far the most important task for biological scientists and ecologists, is to actually study what nature is doing in recombining in response to the disturbances that humans have created, these new ecosystems, because this has been my passion, that these are the models for our more limited efforts to design ecosystems in permaculture. It's what nature does, and it's not the long established ancient co-evolved systems that may have existed in a place. It's actually the ones that are evolving rapidly in response to changed circumstances, you know, whether it's enhanced CO2 in the air, degradation of soils, or for that matter, enhanced nutrition of soils, or many of the endless changes that 7 billion people and, you know, half the world's fossil fuels have generated around the planet, this enormous factors of change. Because, you know, I still believe very strongly that nature's sort of creative, we should call it, creative responses to those problems are going to be the best signs and the best guide for how we should act. And a lot of that, you know, that language sounds like, yes, it's anthropomorphic projection onto nature, you know, and sort of getting very close to sort of, oh, nature as, you know, God consciousness, spirituality. But it's just how the world works, you know, to see things self-organizing themselves into some sort of structure that reflects Odom's maximum power principle, that things that gather together and capture more energy and store it in biomass and build soil and fertility end up prevailing over things that don't do that. And that's the power of nature. That's how nature is powered. And nature needs the diversity of lots of bits, but it also needs power. You know, it needs to be successful. And it finds that path of success through radical disturbances. And we have to learn to do that, even if that path of power is going to be far, far more modest than the fossil fuels that have been powering us in recent generations.
And I don't think that it's necessarily, as I hear your description, as storytellers, as human beings, an anthropomorphic projection is only really a way to describe in a human context the things that are happening in nature as we use the natural processes as a model for how we ourselves can make choices to move forward. I could follow what you were saying, and that makes sense to me. So then, if I could get your ideas on where you think the current crop of permaculture practitioners should go. How do we address the outreach into the world as activists to spread the message? And where do you see permaculture going?
Well, I see the dilemma around how permaculture becomes mainstream versus consolidation into something effective at a local scale is one that is sort of not often articulated, because there's always a big question about how do we make it mainstream? Whereas my focus has always been on how do we get systems that actually work as a living reality and that can pass themselves from one generation to the next successfully, at especially the most simple and fundamental aspect of society at the household level, like how that becomes second generation permaculture successful transition. Now, that seems to many people to be sort of ridiculously sort of small agenda. But what I found over the decades is that if you have powerful working models of success, and success in its own terms, where people are enjoying what they are doing and succeeding, and you have changed social circumstances, changed economic circumstances, where permaculture ways of living and doing things become, it's more obvious that those are beneficial, and those changed circumstances are basically where you get economic contraction. Once you get economic contraction, then it becomes more logical for people to grow some of their own food, to have home-based livelihoods, to be more resilient, to not be in debt. A whole sort of suite of things that at the moment have been pushing against a tide of rising affluence suddenly become normal. Now, the problem is that people rush about ineffectively attempting to do those things and don't make a very good go of it. Or they don't attempt to do them at all because they're not even aware that they're possible. If there are working models in place of people doing that effectively, then the question of how do we get the mainstream to listen becomes a non-issue. The problem becomes, are any of your models transferable? Can they be replicated? Can people learn that fast? It's not an issue of can you persuade them to take notice. Now, I'm saying that from a country where we are now the third richest country in the world in Australia, and this problem for permaculture activism is quite severe, much more so probably than the United States, where, you know, a lot of people can see that the economic and social situation in a lot of places is a lot more shaky. And from our perspective, there seems to be a lot more vibrancy in the interest in permaculture, and even more so in places like Portugal and Spain, where the economic conditions are worse still. So I see that development of working models and talking to the people who are interested and helping them to establish really solid systems that can be replicated at the local scale is absolutely critical. The other argument around this minority approach versus majority approach is that in a political context, there's often a view that until you get the majority of people in a society to sort of change or be interested in change, then none of the large structures change. And what you do at the household level doesn't make sort of much difference, blah, 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 and you've got to change those larger structures. I believe that's wrong in a number of ways. Firstly, the established system, if it's really committed to a particular course of action and it's committed to nothing more than perpetual economic growth, it doesn't matter how many people think that's a bad idea. And we've seen that in willingness to go to war or whatever. You need a lot more than a majority of people wanting to change the direction for the system to actually change direction. On the other hand, if you have 10 or 20% of the population who increasingly seriously disconnect themselves from participation in the destructive economy and seriously build a parallel economy, then that does two things. Well, it does several, actually. Firstly, it builds the resilience of the people who are doing that. But secondly, it actually acts as a brake on growth itself. It's a consumer strike on a significant scale. And if those people are doing well, when the conditions change, then the majority may look at them and say, oh, well, we could be copying them. And what that does also is give greater political leverage, because there is a desperate need for everyone to continue to be a consumer. If people are bailing out with downsizing and, you know, a shift into a permaculture ways of living, of rejuvenation of the household economy, this is actually highly subversive to the monetary economy. And it actually does give much more political leverage than trying to do what, you know, the climate activism community is mostly trying to do, is to get a larger group of people to shout more loudly, to get those in power to pull the levers of power and implement certain policies. I don't believe that that strategy of shouting louder is working at all. And of course, that's one of the things that's attracted people to permaculture in the first place, because it's about creating the world we do want rather than trying to stop the world we don't want. So I think the getting one's own house in order, building the household and community economies as a parallel system, and working where there is the interest and opportunity, and building on what one's own passion and expertise is. So maintaining the holistic big picture of permaculture, but recognizing that in society, you will only get acknowledged as an expert, if you like, or a leader or an innovator in one particular sort of area of permaculture. It might be to do with whether it's mushroom cultivation or, you know, retrofitting old houses to make them energy efficient, or it may be quite a narrow field where you are sort of acknowledged as having some expertise. I think was best put to me by Yascha Roe from the German Permaculture Academy when he said, rather than permaculturists being jacks of all trades and masters of none, we should aim to be jacks of all trades and master of one. And I think that's really important. We do need to be amateurs doing a bit of everything, but we also need to recognize that in our own lifetimes as an individual, we can only become really highly competent in one area, especially if that is an area of innovation and experimentation in itself.
Thank you for that very detailed answer. I appreciate I realize that saying it that way almost sounds like it's laced with a bit of sarcasm, but it's not, because it covers so many of the questions that have been asked of me by my listeners about how we go about practicing this. And so many people, when they talk to me, they're like, well, what can I do with permaculture and a permaculture design certificate if I want to make a career out of it? Does that mean that I have to design or teach, because those are the only two models that I see? And I'm like, well, my first role as a permaculture practitioner is as an interviewer. I practice producing this podcast from a permaculture perspective, leveraging technology to share this message and these different stories with people. And it's like, well, if you're really good as an artist, then go off and find something you can do using these ideas. Make infographics to help share information, and let's work together and collaborate so we can all use our own personal talents, wherever they may be, that you don't have to follow, well, as we say, these dogmatic ideas that we keep seeing.
Wrap a lot of those issues together in that answer. I mean, I know it's they are big issues, and there's sort of no easy answers to those questions. But yeah, hopefully that's a useful contribution to that.
I know plenty of people who will love to hear everything that you've shared with us today, both as a more personal glimpse about you as one of the progenitors of this idea, of one of the two original elders, if you will, of bringing this idea and all of these different pieces together, and to hear your story in a way that many of us haven't. And I thank you very much for taking this time with me. I know we're at about the end of what we have, so thank you for all this time with me.
Thanks a lot, Scott, and good luck with that work you're doing with communicating permaculture.
And that was David Holmgren. I need to say thank you to my teacher, Ben Wise, for his encouragement to reach out to Mr. Holmgren. I'm glad to have had this opportunity to talk with David and fill in some of the questions I had about his path, the role of Howard T. Odom, and where to take permaculture in the future. His suggestion to build working models and focus on people who are already interested and engaged leaves me reconsidering where to take my personal practice from here. So I'm looking at places where I can do more in the zones 0, 1, and 2 of my life, and to serve as a greater example of the possibilities available to write a new story for the future. Also, the conversation about novel ecosystems led to more research on my part between the time that the interview was recorded and the release of the show. Though I'm really just delving into this topic, many questions are answered, but more were raised in my reading thus far. I may need to devote an episode or two to covering novel ecosystems in the future. You'll find links to some of the articles I read, and more, in the show notes at thepermaculturepodcast.com. After listening to this episode, or while reading through some of the resources that are available, if you have any questions or comments, please let me know. show@thepermaculturepodcast.com, or call the voicemail line, 717-827-6266. Next up is Steve Gabriel of the Finger Lakes Permaculture Institute, who also works as an extension program aide at Cornell University. He and I talk about agroforestry from the large to small scale, including forest gardens, riparian buffers, and mushrooms. After that will be the interview with Eric Tonesmeyer about his next book, The Toolkit for Climate Stabilization with Tree Crops, and the Kickstarter campaign he started to support it. And that's going to wrap this episode. Until I join you again, take care of the earth, yourself, and each other.